Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. On this week's programme, it is my pleasure to interview an Irish qualified teacher who is highly regarded as an expert on educational policy in the United States and who is in demand around the world as a consultant on leadership and change in education. Jim Spillan graduated as a primary teacher from St. Patrick's College Drumcondra in 1984. Today, he is the Spencer T. and Anne W. Olin Professor in Learning and Organisational Change at Northwestern University in the United States. He has written numerous articles and his books include Standards Deviation, How Schools Misunderstand Policy and Distributed Leadership. I met up with him at the annual meeting of the American Educational Research Association and we discussed topics related to his area of interest, like how educational policies are implemented, about how research could better inform policy in Ireland, and how change can occur at school level. He also provides advice for the Minister for Education and Skills on educational policy. But I first asked Jim to tell me about organisational routines that can be used to bring about change at school level.
Organisational routines are really at the core of any organisation. They're a staple. Organisations can't function without them. And one of the things that we have been looked at, especially in the transition from a more local autonomy to more state-imposed standards, is how schools respond. And partly the way in which they respond is they try and change the infrastructure or create an infrastructure around teaching and learning. Part of that may be creating or redefining leadership positions. But another part of it is about designing these organizational routines that are designed to change school work practice in general. So think about the teacher who was very much, she or he was left to their own devices. They decided what to teach in the fifth grade. They didn't really talk to the other fifth grade teacher. How do you change that work environment? Well, one of the things maybe is you create grade level meetings where teachers in the same grades come together once a week for half an hour. And they have certain things they work on. They might talk about what they covered that week. They might talk about what materials they're using. They might talk about lesson plans. But that's an example of an organizational routine, faculty meetings, learning.
And the principal's role is to set up the routine and then let the routine do its work. Is that it?
Well, in a lot of our observations, what happens is the principal plus other leaders design these routines. They implement them. But then very often they have to the maintenance of these routines is quite intensive. So if you don't follow up on them, they don't happen. So how do you ensure that the grade level teams meet? How do you ensure that there are learning walks going on in your school? So maintaining these takes quite a bit of work. And I think they're a fundamental way of transforming. We should think about it as structure, if you will. And, you know, without structure, there's really no practice. The only way we can interact with one another is with social structure, and organization routines are part of that. And with that, you can fundamentally change who talks to whom within an organization, what do they talk about. So I think these organizational routines are really very important for thinking about how organizations work, how we can transform organizations. But also, if we think about it, interactions among different organizations. So how can we connect schools with one another? Or maybe, for example, the inspectorate. They have routines, right? They have, I can't remember if they still do them, but schools are reviewed every so often. That's a routine, but it's not just within the organization. It's between two different levels of the system. So understanding these things, and, you know, they don't always work. Some routines are better than others. Thinking about the design principles. I mean, we could think about lesson study as a routine. We could think about video clubs, which are quite popular in mathematics, as a routine.
In his reply to that question, Jim Spillan referred to lesson study and to video clubs for teachers. Lesson study is a model of professional development for teachers that began in Japan but has become popular in the United States and elsewhere. A group of teachers meets to plan a lesson together, and then one of them teaches the lesson to children while other teachers observe how the lesson works in practice. Afterwards, the teachers discuss the lesson, revise the plan, and report on how it went so that other teachers can learn from it. Video clubs are another model of professional development where teachers meet to watch and discuss videotapes of their own and others' teaching and learning in order to improve both. The idea is that the teachers will learn by reflecting together on the authentic record of practice. I next asked Jim if he kept much of an eye on Irish policy now that he's working full-time in the United States.
A little bit. I still talk to quite a few people, Kieran Sugar in particular, but Damien Merchant at Trinity, who was in St. Pat's with me at the same time. So, I haven't been following policy decisions recently, but I stay in touch from time to time.
One of the policies that the Minister for Education and Skills at the moment is trying to do, he's trying to raise literacy and numeracy achievement because we were disappointed collectively with the PISA results the last time. What advice would you give to the Minister in his quest to improve standards of literacy and numeracy in schools?
Well, obviously, the preparation of teachers is critical, but I think Ireland is a luxury in that respect. I think we still cream off some of the top people out of secondary schools, leaving cert exams, into the teaching profession. And that's not true, certainly, in the United States, where there's a huge capacity problem. But obviously, preparation is critical. But I think that only gets you so far. I think you also need to think about what sorts of infrastructure do you have in place in schools and in the system as a whole so that there's ongoing learning, ongoing diagnostic work going on. So, okay, kids don't do well in a particular school in numeracy, in the first class, second class, third class, let's say, right? Do we have the capacity as a school or as a system to do some diagnostic work, figure out what's going on there, and then think not only what interventions we should be doing in the classroom, but how do we create a school environment where there's ongoing learning among the staff? To develop their skills around teaching numeracy, teaching literacy, or assessing numeracy and assessing literacy. It's kind of amazing to me that the institution and society that we charge with learning, knowledge, development, is often horribly impoverished when it comes to the development and learning of the adults in the building.
And probably the reason for that, Jim, is because traditionally we have looked on professional development as being external to the school. But what you seem to be suggesting is that some of that could actually be internal. And I wonder, could you say a little bit more about how that culture within schools could be changed?
Right. I think that's really key. Actually, we have a paper that came out recently with a former student of mine in the Elementary School Journal that looked at this actual issue. We looked at teachers... formal professional development, as we called it, and then their on-the-job learning, and actually found that both were significantly related to their reports of change in practice. Teachers, there's a lot of expertise, a lot of knowledge. Anybody who's worked in a school can tell you, there's a brilliant math teacher, or there's a couple of teachers that are just really wonderful teaching early literacy. There are teachers that really, really get those senior primary school kids to love books, to love good literature, right? But very often we talk about these people, but they're behind closed doors, and the expertise they have never gets shared. So the challenge in creating schools where learning and development, professional learning, and professional development is ongoing, is how do we create an organizational infrastructure so that the expertise that resides in different rooms, in different individuals, gets distributed, gets shared. The other thing, of course, is that by virtue of people working together, people maybe who have different opinions about how you teach kids to read to begin with, by virtue of them working together, maybe around a piece of kids' work, a videotape of a lesson, new insights can begin to emerge. We can develop new knowledge. And, you know, this is so critical, I think, that we're all this notion that the expertise is out there and we have to go out there to get it, or sometimes it comes in to visit us. But we fail to recognize the expertise, the knowledge, the skill that we have here in-house, but that never gets shared, never gets distributed, for various reasons. A lot of them organization. We're all very busy. We think if we're away from our kids, we're not doing our job, when in fact, we may be learning a lot that makes us much better when we're with the kids.
You see, this is where I think that too much of the American life and the American way has rubbed off on you, because you have to remember, in Ireland, if you are good at something, you don't tell anyone else and you don't let on that you're any good at it. You keep it inside your classroom door. How can we do anything about that?
It's taken me 20 years to get away from when somebody compliments you on something or say, no, not at all, sure. Because it is an Irish thing that we know we can. If somebody says to you, you're a great math teacher, you know, sure, I'm not. That's part of it. But I don't think this, what I'm talking about, is actually fits with the American psyche. You know, Americans are very individualistic. It's a very individualistic culture. So in many respects, there's a lot of pushback from this. I can talk about distributed expertise until I'm blue in the face, but people still think of expertise as something that's entirely in here inside the head rather than something that can be distributed. Well, maybe it's time for, you know, modern Ireland to acknowledge when we're good at things and
start asserting itself.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programs can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. My guest today is Professor Jim Spillane from Northwestern University. I next asked Jim how the Minister for Education and Skills will know if the strategy for improving literacy and numeracy is a success.
Well, if he's upset over PISA, I'm assuming he'll rely entirely on test scores, which are the coin of the realm all over the world at the moment. It all comes down to how well do kids do on tests, and where do we rank relative to other countries? Of course, if you know just a little about testing, you know that it doesn't take very much to shift position, to go from a number 10 to a number 17, and more than likely has little to do with what's going on in the education system. I mean, I have no problem looking at some assessments and seeing how well do kids do. But I mean, I would look at broader indicators, you know, indicators of are people reading more in Ireland? You know, I think that would tell me a lot about a society, maybe where books are valued more, where it's important to read. I would also look not just at the number of people that are reaching a certain level, but I would look to see if the inequalities in learning across different groups, if that's being narrowed. I mean, some of these countries that perform very well also have huge problems with certain segments of the population not doing so well. So it's not just about overall performance. It has also to be about equity in who's performing well, and are kids who live in poverty or kids who are not first-generation Irish, are they doing as well as the dominant middle and upper middle class kids who go through the system?
And are there any risks for a minister in deciding to focus on literacy and numeracy and, you know, kind of just concentrating all efforts on those two areas?
Yes, and we've learned this in the US, where although the evidence is mixed, my interpretation is that when we tested mathematics and language arts, those subjects became the dominant focus, especially in our most troubled schools, where it was most difficult to improve scores. So when we were doing work in Chicago in the late 90s, in schools that were under the threat of probation. So in other words, if they didn't get their scores up, the school could be closed. That was the threat. in those schools, it was next to impossible to see a science lesson. So the issue here is that the incentives, if you put incentives in place, if you say it's all about numeracy and literacy, and by God, I'm going to make sure that you're doing good in these, that people will forget our background, other things that we know are important. Science is critical to kids. I think the arts, stuff like that. And we can't afford to narrow the curriculum so that these other subjects lose out in the long run. I think the other thing is, I mean, it's, the big question is, how is the minister defining numeracy and literacy? Is it defined in a very narrow sense of, you know, kids having basic procedural knowledge in mathematics, or is it defined in a much broader sense, where the minister wants kids not only to have be able to add, subtract, divide, but also have a fundamental understanding of the mathematical concepts that goes on behind a lot of these basic procedures? And I'm hoping that it's Ireland and that the minister is thinking broadly about numeracy and literacy.
If we move on, Jim, to your work as a researcher in education, I wonder, how would you describe either or a typical year or a typical week in your work, if there's any such thing?
My mother wonders what I do. So let's pick a teaching quarter. So like, this is spring quarter. I teach on Wednesday morning. I teach advanced qualitative methods, where I have, I think, 10 or 12 graduate students, PhD students, from both human development and social policy, learning sciences, and depending on the year, maybe he's a woman from sociology or psychology. So that's my teaching day. I typically spend Tuesday mornings and Thursday mornings working with my graduate students and postdocs who work with me on projects. So we meet one-on-one, or we meet in groups to discuss whatever we're working on. That could be, we have a survey in the field, what's the response rate, or how do we get the response rate up? We need to schedule interviews for our new principal study. Or we're working on some piece of analysis. What are the findings? Should we run it this way? Should we run it that way? We have a coding scheme for our field notes or our interviews. Is it working? We're not getting high inter-rate reliability. What's wrong with these? It gets more exciting when you're working on a paper and we have a draft. Where do we go from here? Is it holding together? Stuff like that. And then I work all the time, which is horrible. But so 2 days a week, I typically stay home and write. I find I'm more productive when I write at home and there's no interruptions and stuff like that. And of course, I travel quite a bit. Either I'm in the field or I'm going to present a paper or give a talk somewhere. Aside from that, a good meal, a nice glass of wine, a trip to the gym every now and again. That's kind of my work day.
And when you say you work a lot, do you include, is that late evenings or is that weekends or is it everything?
It's everything. It all comes together somehow. But there's, the wonderful thing about this job is you have flexibility. You work when you want to work, but that's not true, because there's always some deadline holding over your head. And, it's a Sunday or it's a Saturday and you say, oh, God, it's a beautiful day, I want to take it off, but I have that paper due next week. It was due a month ago. So, yeah.
You've achieved great success in your academic career, Jim, in the United States. What factors have contributed to that success?
So you don't want me to give you the typical Irish response to, no. Or,
well, it's true and it's well recognized.
Certainly a great interest in education, starting at St. Pat's, I think, that really got me interested in social theory, philosophy with Joe Dunn, I remember, and sociology, and I took geography, which is a very interdisciplinary kind of subject, which that really got me thinking about how things work. I think the the wonders of being doing a PhD is, you know, you spend 5 years, as you know, you spend 5 years being an apprentice to these wonderful, talented people who, of course, work very hard. And then after you get your PhD, you spend another 6 years as an assistant professor, where you have to write and produce, or they'll say goodbye to you after a few years. But and in doing that, you learn, I think, a way of working that I think it's even post tenure is very hard to give up. So a lot of it is hard work. A lot of it is really being motivated by an interest in trying to improve the life chances of kids, especially poor kids and kids who traditionally have been disenfranchised by our education systems, whether it's Ireland or England or the United States. So I think that, but, you know, the wonderful thing about working in academia in the U.S. is that a lot of the work is collaborative. We work with others. You form new collaborations, or you go back to old ones. My mentor and I, David Cohn, are just working on an idea for a research proposal. So that's very exciting, rolling back after 20 years or so. So, yeah.
And you've mentioned there, Jim, that it all started in Ireland and in St. Pat's, but you did come to the United States to do your postgraduate study. Do you think you could have had the level of success that you've had here had you stayed in Ireland?
As a researcher, as an academic, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think, first of all, Ireland at that time did not have any thought PhDs. It was purely research PhDs. So coming to the U.S., I think really I learned an awful lot from true coursework. But I think the other thing, the opportunities in the U.S. due to grant money, due to the investment, just by sheer size of the country and its wealth, I guess, you know, the investment in social science research is tremendous compared to Ireland and compared to most of Europe, indeed. And, you know, those resources make a difference, and not just the financial ones, but the intellectual ones and the availability and the access to people like that.
And finally, Jim, what could be done in Ireland, again, if we go back to advising the Minister for Education and Skills, what could be done in Ireland to raise the standing or the influence of educational research on policymaking in the country?
I really think a grants program, and I'm not aware that one exists, like the British have a version of this. It's the Economic and Social Research Council or something. The name escapes me. But I really think a national competitive grants program that funds research around topics that the minister, the government, or perhaps a committee of academics that's elected or that evolves over time. It's some sort of an advisory board, so that there is an annual or biannual competition for research in areas that are relevant to teaching or relevant to the practice of education, relevant to education policy, or even some basic research. I think something like that, even as a relatively small investment, could really raise the profile of education research in Ireland. I think the minister might be very pleasantly surprised about how useful such research might be in making decisions. And a lot of countries have these. The U.S. has several, but the National Science Foundation, the Institute of Education Sciences, the British have their own version. But I think something like that, so that the education research is conducted not by just a small group of people who happen to be the national education researchers, but that you engage the whole community of scholars across various universities, in the enterprise and give them the opportunity to compete, to do important work.
And presumably their focus, though, as you said, would have to be very tight, because otherwise you could have, you know, a little bit of money spread over such a wide amount of questions that you get nowhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can think about that in two ways. One is you can say, so the minister is currently worried about numeracy and literacy. So that would make a lot of sense that he's going to say, well, for the next two or three years, this national research kitty for education, 75% of it is going to go to numeracy and literacy. And here are, in particular, questions that are key to the field. And 25% is open for people to propose projects, propose good ideas. Because the one thing we need to be careful about, right? Numeracy and literacy is the topic of today. Something else will pop up in two, maybe 18 months, right? But so constantly seeding the system with ideas. So letting people out there say, look, this is an important research topic. I'm asking you for 15, 20K to give me 18 months to do this study on it. And I think that could be potentially very powerful. So you can use both strategies. It's not clear to me that the minister, the Department of Education, should be the folks in charge of this pot of money. That I think it would make a lot more sense if there was some independence. You know, you certainly have representation from the ministry, from the inspectorate, but also from the academy, and you know, maybe parents and teachers, that kind of says, here's the agenda, and then have a panel of experts who decides who gets the money. It gets a little tricky in Ireland because it's a small country and everybody knows everybody else, and you didn't fund my grant, you know. What was wrong? So, but I think it, for a relatively small investment, I know times are really bad, but for a relatively small investment, I think you could get potentially great returns. And I think it may be a cheaper model than creating a one entity that does all the research.
And that was Professor Jim Spillan from Northwestern University speaking to me at the annual meeting of the American Educational Research Association. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, Professor Jim Spillan. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Thank you.